Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, March 10th. This weekend marked 50 years since the launch of the Hokulea. We talked to Hawaii navigator Nainoa Thompson of the Polynesian Voyaging Society about the group's future and its past. We also hanahoa a conversation with a documentary filmmaker in a new telling of Hokulea's history. Plus, we hear about a new survey on religious affiliation in the U.S. How do religious identities in Hawaii compare to the rest of the country? And the Hawaii Youth Symphony turns 60. We talk to the president and CEO about an upcoming collaborative concert with the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This weekend celebrated the first launch of Hokulea some 50 years ago. Thousands of people came together at Kualoa, including many who were present at that first ever launch. Musician Paula Fuga performed her song Hokulea, Star of Gladness. In anticipation of the anniversary events this weekend, HBR's Cassie Ordonio spoke with Nainoa Thompson, Hawaii navigator and CEO of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, about the principles that have guided the organization's work over the last several decades and how he views the next generation of voyagers.
Hokulea's 50th birthday is coming up. How do you view especially this generation of voyagers?
I view them as being essential. In fact, one of our ways that we actually measure whether we're still relevant and we're still of value and there's meaning in voyaging is whether young people come or not. We'd rather people take the initiative to come down and start their training by taking care of the kunu, the dry docking. Thousands and thousands of volunteer hours to make sure Hokulea is seaworthy and she's safe to carry young people. This generation's interesting because the world is changing so fast. And it's hard now, you know, the time is hard. You know, my view is that back 50 years ago, it was a lot easier to find the time to come down and just train and spend time with nature and sailing. It's harder now. The pressure on young people is immense. They're asked to do an awful lot in their lives. So my view of the young people is that the ones that we have, they're extraordinary. And I see it because they somehow balance their lives and find time to be a part of the totality of what it takes to sail deep. The young are vital because if they don't come, that means you become irrelevant. That means your organization is going in the wrong direction. If they don't come, it means that there's something wrong with our connection to young people. And I say that why it's so crucial is because if young people don't come and they don't learn, we're going to forget again. I think it takes one generation. The navigation is so complex and it's so difficult. It takes so many years to be ready to go deep sea, navigate 2,500 miles and find a small island in the ocean. It's not easy. And that road to get there is a sacrifice and it's a challenge. Hokulea is constantly challenging us to have to explore, to have to learn, and then to share. If young people don't come, then what I'm afraid of the most is that our generation could be viewed as the last, and we'll do the same thing we did 200 years ago when early European voyagers came and they had all that whole story of loss of Native Hawaiians and so forth, because the older generation made a promise to our teachers that we're not going to let the sailing and the voyage and the navigation go extinct. If young people don't come, you don't have a choice. We call it the COVID group because they came in starting in 2019 and bam, in 2020, we had to shut down. It was more complex for them. Health and safety became priorities above everything. The restrictions were difficult. We still trained during COVID. We still sailed, but our doctors built a very strong commitment to the regulations of COVID. Now, I'll say that we cannot trace a single COVID case to being at Hokulea throughout the whole 3 or 4 years of COVID. So the system worked, but it was hard. And I'd characterize this crew, and I'll tell you a story. It's why I'm so excited about them. This is a crucial time, 50 years. So this is 50 years of change. We look back at the first 50 years and we thank primarily teachers. Without them, we couldn't voyage. Imagine 50 years ago on March 8th, they launched a voyaging canoe and nobody knew how to sail it, let alone navigate it. So our ability to do things like sail around the world is because everything was learned. We learned everything. We didn't know anything. We started at ground zero and everything was learned. Therefore, you have to honor those who taught you. It's about the power of the teacher. And that's at the heart of voyaging to me. It's the power of the teacher. My humble belief is that the real purpose for the navigators is not just to go find islands. In fact, I would say the highest level of navigation, this is my opinion, and this just comes from just conversation with my teacher, Maopialuk from Micronesia, that the highest level of navigation is the teacher. So I knew when COVID came, we had a problem here because I don't know if we can hold these young ones because it was so restrictive and it was a scary time. And it was a time when there was a lot of doubt. There was a lot of fear. My fear was we couldn't hold them because they had so much to learn and the experiences were so restrictive. But that's not what happened. What we did, I think, is really important to understand. We recognize that we navigate by many, many values that we're taught. Safety and health, number one priority, especially with the dark cloud of COVID. So we changed the training of the navigators in 2020. All the kind of specific things you'll do on the canoe to become a good sailor, that's important, but became more important was teaching values first. During COVID, we were doing training runs up to Papahanaumokuakea, the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. We did training up there, and so it's like the best training ground, because even though the voyage is like only 120, 150 miles long, you're looking for a small island in Tahiti. So you have to be very precise, very accurate. And the difference was we trained to this issue of malama, of caring for Hokulea and caring for each other. Yeah, we made rules, and there were different rules. It was like, if you're going to do your swimming tests at night, which we do tests at night in the dark, and you're in a partner, if you leave your partner behind, we cut you. You never do that. And the training, we even up to Papahanaumokuakea, we said that we don't care if you don't find the island. What we care about is you care for the canoe and you care for each other. And it had a profound impact, I think, on these young ones, that those values became the guiding light. That was 2020. It was restrictive. And bam, you know, we're going to do a Moananuakea voyage. Every time we go outside the Polynesian Triangle, we ask permission from our elders. And our elders in this, on an island called Raiatea, on a Marae Tapu Tapuatea, which is clearly, Polynesians all know, that was the most powerful navigation school in Polynesia all these thousands of years. So Hokulea needs to go down to Tapu Tapuatea, needs to talk to the elders, needs to get permission to leave, because our destination was 60 degrees north in Yakutat Bay in Alaska. You're out there in the glaciers. And so the question at that time in 2022 is, who navigates? Who is going to captain this voyage? Should it be us old goats? That they're tired of looking at us. They're tired of listening to us. And, you know, the decision for who's going to captain and navigate, it has to be a statement of advancement. And so what we did was we picked a crew of young people. Half were in their 20s. Half never sailed long before. We trained to this on values and less on the mechanics and the specifics of sailing. That's easy. And then we chose the captain and the navigator would be the same person, and it would be a woman. So it's the first woman that we know of next to Pele that would cross the road from Hawaii to Kahiki Nui, 2,400 miles called Kealaʻi Kahiki, the pathway to home, to and from home. And so I got strong pushback from the senior guys because they said, yeah, it's the right thing to do to give them the challenge, to give them the responsibility, but they're not ready. And I kind of knew that, but the question in my mind is, when are they going to be ready? And the question is not so much, when are they going to be ready? When are you going to give them opportunity to test themselves? Against the advice, I towed them out to Kumukahi on the Big Island from Hilo, and let them go. And I was on the voyage on a computer, right? You can see the tracking on the computer. And so, of course, I followed them. And on the computer, we have this thing called a course line. It's drawn from Kumukai in the Big Island to an island called near Rangiroa. It's in the Tuamotu Archipelago. That's their target. And that line is called, it's a reference course. It's a course that you reference to. It's complex in a navigation system. You can't tell longitude. And so you can't do it without precise instruments. You can't do it without a chronometer to tell time. And you can't do it without things like speed and so forth. So this reference course is really tells you where you are on that voyage. And so we let them go. And then I was watching them, and they were precise, and they were excellent. They're right on that line. And they don't know it. You know, they don't have any, they have no information about where they are in reference to the line. And they were just precision and fast. And then I was, you know, it was an interesting thing that impacted me about, you know, the storms inside of me. They were going so well in the beginning. I was so happy for them, but this actually happened to me. They were too good that they're having record time. And this is like the 13th voyage? My first voyage, it took me 33 days to get to Tahiti. They're in record time. And then just kind of unconsciously, I started not to feel good about this anymore because they're too good. And if they're too good, then what does that make me? That's the storm inside, right? Fear and envy, and where's your role? And if they're that good. And so they got to the doldrums, and where you can get becalmed, and you could get stuck in there. And there's two big giant lightning storms, both one to the east, one to the west, bigger than the state of Hawaii, massive storms. And they went, and right in between had no idea that those storms are there, except for they could see the top to the lightning on both sides. And right to the doldrums, they got into the southeast trade winds. And then they were going straight for an island to the east of Rangiroa. And they don't know it. They don't know it. And they were precise. Everything we told them to do, they did it with that level of excellence. I didn't see it on the canoe, but I could see it on the course line. And then they got down to the Tuamotu Archipelago. They saw the birds. They did everything right. You know, you see the birds, put the sails down at night. There's two species of birds we use to find islands because they go out to see the fish, but they come back at night. So you just follow their path. They knew the islands were there. They didn't know exactly where they were, and they didn't know which one it was. But they know by the stars where they were, because I know they were telling me their position by latitude and then the reference course and so forth. So honestly, I wasn't celebrating. I was scared that they're just going to be too good. I flew down to Rangiroa, and I took a power boat out to pull them into the channel. Very strong currents there. Brought them to this beautiful place, this huge sandbar, pristine, clean, full of life, and I anchored them there. They were taken in by another boat, and I didn't go in. I took the boat I had. I went and I put it someplace else, and I just walked. And I didn't congratulate them. I didn't come see them. I hid. Because I didn't know who I am now, given that they're that precise and they're that good. And they were half the time I took to get my first voyage. So that night, they were having dinner, and they were really perplexed. Like, where are you, Nainoa? And I took a one-man canoe in the dark. I paddled out to the canoes. I just went out there by myself on the sandbar and just to, you know, thank these canoes for, you know, safely carrying these young people. And yet I had this very difficult decision to go, when are you going to go see them? And I couldn't, in the frame of mind and the emotional state I was, but I was rubbing Hokulea in the dark on the sandbar. And my father passed away on Christmas Day in 2001, but he's always my navigator. And so I was kind of rubbing the hulls in the dark by myself on the one-man canoe. And he came to me, and he said to me, Nainoa, you get in that beach, and when you see these young people, you need to thank them. This gets to your question about education. You need to thank them because they're better than you, and that's your job, that you're never going to be able to walk away from this canoe until you know that the younger people are better than you. That's your job, because he said to me, that's how you're going to stop extinction. And so I went in and I met with them. It was amazing, but it was just these storms inside of ourselves. Yeah, you know, the big storms on the ocean, they're beautiful, they're powerful, and you can do it and handle it because you're taught to be, first, humble, and then, two, you pay respect to the storm. If you don't, they'll kill you. And you always pay attention to them. The storms on the sea are easy. For me, the storms inside are much harder. It's not like I'm transcending to become the teacher. I'm frankly descending to become the student because of what I know I need to know. I need to understand that my dad's correct. Your job is to make them better than you. And which allowed me to thank them and allowed me to be so proud of them. It's my job.
That's my job. That was Master Navigator Nainoa Thompson and HPR's Cassie Ordonio. She sat down with Thompson before the Hokulea anniversary celebrations this weekend. The Hokulea is currently docked at the Alawai near the convention center. Student tours will be conducted starting this afternoon. We'll have links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Leeward Theatre. Na Le Hulu Ika Veikiu performs Kupu Kupu, a new production featuring musical twists, March 15th and 16th. leeward.hawaii.edu/theater.
I was sentenced to die in prison.
Walter Johnson received 5 life sentences for robbery and drug crimes, but a couple of decades later, he was released by the same judge who originally sentenced him.
I used to dream about being out. I would wake up and still be in. That's one of the most beautiful things, knowing that it's not a dream.
Judges who grant second chances and why. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 85 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
The 2023 documentary Hokulea, Finding the Language of the Navigator, tells the story of how Hawaiians reacquired the skills to navigate the ocean on long voyages. It focuses on a conversation between Master Navigator Nainoa Thompson and cultural anthropologist Wade Davis. It also pays homage to Maupiailuk, the Micronesian wayfinder, who taught his navigational skills to Thompson and others in the 1970s. Native Hawaiian filmmaker Tai Sanga directed the documentary, and he spoke with HPR's Russell Sobiano last year.
What gave you the idea to do the film?
In 2022, I've been collaborating with, you know, my producers, Anne Boracelli and Heather Juni. We've been making a few documentaries for Hokulea. Mm-hmm. We're following the latest voyage out to Tahiti. So we did some short videos with them, and then, you know, we had an opportunity to do a longer format documentary, and they pitched an idea with, you know, Nainoa being available and reconnecting with Wade Davis, who he had met a decades back, to kind of reconnect and see where their journey is. And it was like, that's kind of exciting because, you know, Nainoa's almost, you know, like it's like 40 years of him being able to do, you know, celestial navigation. And it's evolved and changed since the beginning. So reflecting on the past and also looking towards what's the potential future, yeah.
There have been several documentaries about Hokulea that have come out in the last few years. What makes your documentary unique?
Yeah, we actually do highlight this current sail, the Moana Nui Akea voyage right now. But also because of, like I mentioned, that, you know, we're creeping on almost 50 years of Hokulea's existence. So just Nainoa being able to kind of reflect on that and, like, you know, in the documentary, he talks about it. He's like, his time is coming. He's ready to kind of step back and let the next generation lead. I know he said that many times in the past, but, like, this time it's feeling like we're getting closer towards that. And so, like, you know, Mao used to talk about, like, if you want to get navigators, send me your children because you're too old. And so when you think about that and you think about Nainoa doing celestial navigation for 40 years, like, how much has he grown? And what kind of knowledge has he's gathered? And with all his mentors that have guided him, he was able to kind of, like, hit, like, big touch points in his career as a navigator and some of the fears that he faced. Mm. So that was really inspiring because you don't really get to see him talk about, I mean, he does talk about all of the fears quite often, but we're able to kind of document it in this film, specifically his first time sailing as a navigator.
knowing that Hawaiians had lost the part of their culture where they're able to navigate the oceans prior to the launch of Hokulea, do you get the sense that Nainoa feels, you know, a little bit of pressure to make sure that his knowledge passes on to the next generation?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, that's been the objective for Polynesian Voyaging Society and, you know, the Ohana Va'a, that everyone's been kind of, you know, Nainoa is just one of the many navigators that Mau passed on that knowledge to, and then it's trickled down into the communities, you know, on each island. And it's very important for us to continue to celebrate and to nurture that, that next generation's. For Nainoa, I mean, the one thing that we got to explore in this film, because we're just talking about the technical stuff about it, right? But there's something deeper when you're talking about sailing out at sea, something deeper than all of this knowledge that goes on. It's very much like a Wade talks about it, like a musician. He's like, the music plays the musician, not the musician plays the music. There's a spiritual side to it, another side that you can't really explain. But if you're there and you're present and you're listening to the ocean and the waves and everything that's going on in nature, something spiritual is happening, either your kupuna is guiding you and stuff like that. So Nainoa is able to share some moments of that. And those are things that, you know, you really can't teach. That's something that you just have to be on the va'a and learn and be present. So with all these current sales coming up, you know, there's wonderful opportunities for the next generation to experience that.
In your film, Master Navigator Nainoa Thompson says, "You have to know the language of the ocean or you die. We were searching for the language of the navigator." How were those originally involved with Hokulea? How were they able to find those languages, the language of the ocean and of the navigator?
It took, and like how I said, Mau mentioned, like, you know, send your children because you're too old.
Yeah.
And so it took many years for him, for Nainoa folks to, and I'm still very, I am in no way knowledgeable to explain any of this because there's so much complexities to it. But he had many mentors and educators throughout his career, reaching from Aotearoa to be able to sail within the southern hemispheres. You know, the folks at Bishop Museum allowing him to study the stars there and just being able to just apply a lot of that knowledge that Mau was able to share with Nainoa and then kind of adapting to it, because adapting to our hemisphere as well, you know, adapting to our waves. And one major thing about the language of the navigator is like a lot of it is about being present and watching change happen in the environment. So in order to know where you're going, you have to kind of find the placement you are in on your voyage and then see how everything is changing around you, and that will guide you of what your position is so you can make the decision to move forward next. And so we thought that, you know, and specifically for Nainoa, it was important to get that information out there specific, and with this upcoming sale of Moana Nu'akea, because as global warming is happening, those changes are drastically happening. They're able to see that. These navigators, these folks out there on this ocean have been seeing these changes happen rapidly. So many times it's scary to know, like, if that's what where we're going, how things are going to shape out. So the mission of Moana Nu'akea became very, very clear for him, yeah.
Wow, I hadn't even thought about how climate change was going to affect being able to navigate the ocean. And you've mentioned Mau a couple of times. For those listening who aren't familiar with Mau, the folks that built the Hokulea, he was the person that they found to help them regain the knowledge of navigating the ocean, right? Can you just talk a little bit about Mau?
Yeah, Mau, you know, is very special. And we definitely, in the documentary, have a huge section to highlight him because, you know, we couldn't have done it. The Hawaiians, we would have failed that Tahiti sail if he wasn't there. So he, Ben Finney, Herb Connie, you know, a lot of them, you know, back then they reached out to a number of navigators that were out in the Pacific. And thankfully, he was actually here on Oahu when they were trying to find a navigator. And so, you know, he agreed to help sail down to Tahiti. And then, you know, after that second sail that failed, we realized that, you know, like, Mau needed to help share that knowledge of navigation to Nainoa guys. And that's kind of, none of this could have happened without him. And he's a big part of that revitalization of our culture and identity. But also, like, he is just one of many navigators from his community in Micronesia, too. So we kind of stand on their shoulders, and we're grateful for all of that. And we couldn't have done it without any of them.
And much of your film is an oral history of how Hawaiians were taught the language of the ocean and the language of the navigator. And what pops out to me is how it seems to be kind of like this serendipitous series of key people meeting other key people who have this key piece of knowledge. In fact, you kind of mentioned that Mao was the one that taught the Hawaiian navigators, and he just happened to be on Oahu, right? So what kind of gave me chicken skin was just seeing how there just happened to be all these dots that just kind of connected that worked out. As you were making the film, what were your thoughts when you started seeing all these dots start to connect?
That's funny and beautiful that you mentioned all of that. Yeah, you know, I've been making movies for the past decade or so, and you know, a lot of the stuff that I do in documentaries, it's for me, it's very spiritual. The stories, you know, I have a rough idea of where we're gonna go in regards to the story and the narrative, but it speaks to you at certain moments. You know, certain things kind of unravel, especially when we're doing with this something so deep with historical. So there's, you know, there's stories hidden in other areas that you kind of, you never knew about, and then sometimes they just appear. That's almost relating very much to what Naino was talking about during his first sail. And, you know, when they hit the doldrums, you know, he's like, you prepare, but sometimes there's like another level of, I don't know if it's a kupuna or whatever is happening, but someone else shines a light on specific stories or moments. So you're prepared enough to get into the right place, and then the rest of the world or Akua happens, you know. And that usually, when that moments happen, and that's when I know we're doing a good thing, because it feels like we're on the right path. And so, yeah. Like, just being, for me as a filmmaker, you know, and we're just observers, you know, so just being present to be aware of all of those things and cognizant of those moments, so, yeah.
What I think is some of the most impactful things that the Hokulea voyages are doing is inspiring other indigenous cultures to revive their relationship with the ocean or with water, and pointing out to the world as a whole, you know, just how important stewardship of the ocean is. Can you talk about how Hokulea is able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, some of these communities are way more advanced than we are. You know, some of them are deeper. You know, they've nurtured their relationship with the environment. They've never had the outside pressures of governments and other things, other larger entities. So, like, the folks in Alaska, you know, like, that's where we get a lot of the spruce logs came from there, you know. And so with Hokulea having this larger platform, and I know that was one of the angles that we saw when we decided to do this documentary with, you know, Anne and Heather, was that our job is to help amplify the rest of the community within the Pacific, within the world, and our indigenous communities, because, you know, they're the ones listening to the environment. They're the ones present in their areas. And we can't go in there and tell them what to do, because they're the guardians of that area. So in order to help tackle climate change, we need to be able to amplify all of these voices, because even though they all exist in pockets, we all kind of, there's like a domino effect, and we have to, and it eventually it's going to touch everyone. So with Hokulea having this platform, and with the sale coming up, being able to visit some of these places and maybe allow the communities to speak and share their voices and share what the amazing things that they're already doing, as well as, you know, amplifying what's been going on and what they've been recognizing that's been threatening their livelihood. It's only the right steps we need to take as we move forward to try to tackle the climate change.
Taisanga, thank you so much for your time, man. Really appreciate you coming to the studio.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Russell. Hopefully you can do this again.
Yeah.
That was a 2024 interview between filmmaker Taisanga and HBR's Russell Subiono. Sanga's documentary is titled Hokulea, Finding the Language of the Navigator, and it's been winning awards on the festival circuit in Hawaii, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omau, okaho'olawe, ohawai. Later in today's show, we'll be talking with Hawaii Youth Symphony's president and CEO, Randy Wong. The Youth Symphony marks its 60th anniversary this season, and it's putting on a special side-by-side concert with the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra to celebrate. For today's quiz, we're exploring the history of these side-by-side concerts. The fall 2023 concert hosted 150 musicians at the Waikiki Shell Amphitheater, one of the largest groups to play the venue. Performers ages 14 to 70 shared the stage and performed pieces by Tchaikovsky, Berlioz, and Marquez. But the first ever side-by-side concert took place nearly 50 years ago. It was held on Saturday, September 17th, 1977, at the McKinley High School Auditorium. The theme was A Taste of Symphony. We want to know who conducted this first side-by-side concert featuring musicians from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra alongside members of the Youth Symphony. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing solutions for homeless residents living on the island of Maui, such as Home Aid Hawaii, nāreithawaii.com.
Calling Hawaii college students. Want a taste of what it's like to work in radio? Thinking about becoming a content creator or pursuing a career in live event production? Hawaii Public Radio is offering a summer internship in collaboration with Kamehameha Schools. For more information, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
You know, it's interesting that 78% of Americans identified as religious back in 2007, but that number has been steadily declining over the past 18 years. A Pew Research Center report shows that the decline has ended. The conversation C.W. Gibson talked to the University of Hawaii Religious Studies professor Jonathan Pettit about the findings and what the report can and can't tell us about how people identify their religious beliefs here in Hawaii. Pettit begins by addressing why the overall number might be stabilizing around 62%.
You know, in the late 60s into the 80s and early 90s, you saw a really big shift in the, you know, grandparents or a parent's generation that attached themselves to a particular religious identity, and their children turning a new stone, like adopting new religious identities and beliefs and belongings. And so now you're into the grandchildren generation, right? So it's already a generational shift has happened where the decline in those attachments to the identity have already been lost in the parents' generation. And we're looking at the children's and now even the grandchildren's generation from, say, World War II into the present day, that the reaching a kind of stasis of how people identify themselves and kind of rejection against some of those old norms.
The report, I think, uses this word stickiness, referring to how likely someone is to retain the religion they grew up with or remain non-religious if that's how they grew up. And the stickiness factor with those who grew up in a religious setting seems to be going down, according to the report, while the stickiness of a non-religious upbringing is rising. Do you have any thoughts on that?
All these cases, there's kind of a general trend for not just religion, but in kind of institutional structures and more generally for young people to kind of work against the attaching them to any sense of institutional belonging, kind of a turn towards the local and maybe a grassroots level of a kind of identity and a refusal to take a larger kind of identity. So for certainly for religion, it's not surprising that you see a trend towards turning away from maybe more traditional monikers or markers of religious belonging and identity and attaching themselves to something more local and meaningful and personal, or shopping around for identities and thinking who they want to be. So kind of the old larger markers of institutional identity are starting to fade away. You know, in that case, I think the generation in the 21st century is much more fluid and open to discussion and kind of a negotiation of their own identity or their own sense of being. So they're not attached to particular old religious identities of belonging. Yeah.
You know, the report dials down on Hawaii and Honolulu specifically too. One data point where the state seems to buck the national trends is with evangelicals. They make up 23% of adults across the country, but just 20% in Hawaii. And that number shrinks even more to 17% if you dial down on Honolulu. Any thoughts on dynamics that might drive this lower rate of evangelical respondents in Hawaii?
Even a category like evangelical is open to debate and what that means. And if you ask somebody who's 20 years old, 30 years old, 50 years old, and 80 years old what evangelical means in evangelical Christianity, you know, in the past, maybe that is a kind of marker of religious identity or denominational belonging. But for, you know, a lot of young people today, being evangelical, the term means something quite different than their grandparents. So, you know, one thing that to read the Pew report with some amount of a critical eye, so to speak, is that there are a lot of evangelical Christianities that operate in Hawaii and U.S. and generally, right? They don't even call themselves evangelical, but they're still like have some of the evangelical components, right? So there's this aspect in the U.S. where people may not call themselves evangelical, but they still embody some of those old markers of what evangelical mean, an old religion, a new skin.
Are there aspects of Hawaii's religious landscape that you think got left out of the discussion in this report?
The idea of multiple belongings, so the idea that a person can identify with multiple religious traditions on any given day or hour or season of the year, right? That people can often appeal to different aspects of their spirituality. And, you know, in our state, we have people that have like 8 different belongings, right? You're Samoan, you're Chinese, you're Japanese, you're Filipino, you're Cornish, whatever you are, right? That's like you have multiple kinds of belongings, and to try to distill it down to like one thing that I am can often be difficult for someone who is grown up in a melting pot of a society, which we have. So things like the Pew Report will often think about people as unilateral beings, right? And not give a lot of voices for those different kinds of belongings. And sometimes it kind of disenfranchises people that have a lot of contradictions and complications, which we certainly have a lot in our state. Kind of privileges people that have a very clear, like, yes, I am, you know, I am Muslim, I am Christian, I am Hindu, I am Jewish, right? It can often peripheralize people that whose answers aren't so clear. That's a problem for us. We should really think about what those numbers mean and kind of call them into question.
Yeah, so this point you're making about some sense of increased fluidity when it comes to religious identity, it sounds like you're saying this is exceptionally pronounced in sort of the cultural brew that is the Hawaiian Islands and the communities that we have here.
Yeah, that's for sure. If you want to compare the experience of religion in Honolulu versus Bismarck, North Dakota, or take your dartboard pick, you know, Tucson, Arizona, or Tallahassee, Florida, right? That they're, you know, the U.S. is a very complicated landscape. And even Columbus, Ohio is a great example, right? Where you have a lot of immigrants from North Africa and kind of other places that kind of break the mold. And so there are lots of interesting areas to compare. But certainly what Honolulu brings to the table in our state more generally, that we can kind of at least challenge some of these results, is the fluidity and hybridity and, I guess, like complicated identities that seemingly everyone here has, right? It's a bricolage or a repertoire of different identities and islands.
And all of this obviously interfaces with politics, right? How do you see that playing out in the report?
In the U.S. today, what you often see is a polarization of political identity and its alliance with the association with a Christian identity. So conservative politics, certainly in the past, you know, a few election cycles, you think back to you know, 2016, when Donald Trump was being elected for president the first time, and Mike Pence has this conservative Christian alliance, right? And a lot of evangelical and conservative Christians ally themselves with a political candidate in that way. But at the same time, you have a polarization where there are progressive Christians that are working on the opposite end of those issues and kind of issues of social justice, you know, reconciliation, economic equality, and environmental stewardship. You know, there are all these examples of any kind of religious group, with Christian and Muslim and Jewish are the most common ones in the U.S., but lots of others as well. You know, so certainly in the past decade, we've seen religion becoming a much more prominent part of people's identity, but often in very polarizing and very extreme ways, right? Less and less in the middle. You know, at the same time, in UH Manoa, we have a class religion and environment where we look, you know, lots of different cases. One of them is conservative Christians that support climate crisis and green economic change, right? So there are even extreme peoples who you may not associate with typical inside of the issue, and but their religious beliefs are really shaping their convictions and their sense of belonging and their attachment in ever-changing and shifting ways.
I feel like a discussion of religion is in some ways a discussion about contradictions, and you've spoken to those a lot here, and also just cultural and popular divides we're seeing across society now. I think we're hearing from you that those are mirrored or contained also in the discussion about religious identity.
For sure. And we should take solace in that these aren't new things either, right? That you really go back for the past century and more that we've been collecting these kinds of examples in our own U.S. society, right? Religion has profoundly shaped a sense of purpose, like for ourselves and our community and our family and our state and our nation, right? It's a these kind of debates or these sense of what we need to do. And obviously, as the 50th state, it's Hawaii has the shortest history of any state, but in some ways, maybe we have the most important history to bring to the rest, of the most relevant and the most recent and the most complicated in many ways.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today, John.
Yeah, thank you.
That was UH Religious Studies Professor Jonathan Pettit talking to The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about the latest Pew Research Center report on religious affiliation in the U.S. You can find the report, including Hawaii-specific data, on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
Mokuo ke ave. Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation and Kanikabila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian Billy Bergen, UH biology professor Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainani Kahaunaele. For more information, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Big Island Coffee Roasters and Merriman's Restaurants.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Now it's time to present the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the nearly 50-year history of the side-by-side concerts featuring musicians from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra and the Hawaii Youth Symphony. The 2023 concert held at the Waikiki Shell was surely a highlight, featuring 150 musicians. We also took you back to 1977, when the first side-by-side concert was held at the McKinley High School Auditorium. Wielding the baton in front of the group was an accomplished violinist who had studied the art of conducting in Maine and Europe. At the time, he was commuting between Honolulu and Reading, Pennsylvania, to conduct both symphonies. And later in his career, he would lead orchestras in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Florida at the same time. He eventually gave up two of those gigs due to scheduling issues. And we asked you for the name of the conductor of the very first side-by-side concert in Hawaii. We were looking for Sidney Rothstein, and it's terrific because the winner today, John Hamilton from Sunset Beach, says his friends played in that concert. How cool is that? That's our quiz. If you have one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, this Wednesday evening, the Hawaii Youth Symphony will be playing side by side along members of the Honolulu Symphony Orchestra in the return to the Neil Blaisdell Concert Hall, which has been under much needed renovations. It's a homecoming of sorts for the Youth Symphony. We talked to President and CEO Randy Wong recently about how the organization is celebrating its 60th anniversary in our community.
It's a wonderful homecoming, I think, for HYS. We used to have all of our concerts there, and this will be the first time, because it's the first time since the pandemic, it will be the first time that our Hawaii Youth Symphony students have performed in the Blaisdell.
Wow, so this is really going to be something. It's going to be really meaningful.
Super meaningful. I mean, it's going to be an intergenerational celebration. You know, of course, we've got our Hawaii Youth Symphony kids that start at age 7 all the way up till 18, and they're going to be performing as stand partners with the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. And then it's also the closing of the HSO Beethoven Festival. So it's kind of an intergenerational celebration that is going to reimagine Beethoven's legacy.
Yeah, I mean, what a wonderful series. And, you know, the fact that you folks are marking your 60th is just, oh my gosh, tremendous.
Yeah, I mean, the Hawaii Youth Symphony has been around since 1964. And I think we're one of the longest standing arts partners, you know, in town. Always with a mission and vision, you know, to serve Hawaii youth at whatever level they are to become the best humans that they can, you know, through music. Just wonderful opportunity for us to kind of celebrate that growth.
And I know many of our hosts on the classical side of HPR were members of the symphony when they were young.
Yeah, yeah. Kealii Loma Lanzalotti, one of our first students, cellist. And actually, her two daughters were both in Hawaii Youth Symphony. So there's a two-generation family right there. You know, she went on to become a conductor and, of course, is now has a great career in public radio. Shireen Lumtaba of Classical Pacific and her husband, Dean, a jazz musician, both alums of HYS. And she was a violinist, I believe, in HYS, but now, you know, known as a harpist. Ashley Mizuo, your reporter, you know, your journalist. And Crystal Spear, I believe, your director of operations. All had starts in HYS. And so that right there is a great example of community building, you know, from music to the greater community. All HYS alum.
Well, we're very proud of all the skills that you have taught them being a part of the symphony's history. But yeah, I mean, why is this so important to keep this arts organization going?
You know, I think anytime that we can give children pathways to discover themselves, you know, to have safe places where they can have free expression and, you know, channel their creative juices, learn about something that's larger than themselves. I mean, the arts and music are such reminders of what, you know, what a healthy civilization, you know, can be. And so as we give kids the opportunity to participate in that, they become better people. They get to know themselves better. They get to know each other, you know, other kids from other backgrounds. HYS has, you know, more than 700 students from across the state, you know, representing over 100 schools. And so you're sitting side by side with peers who, you know, may come from different backgrounds, but you're all working to achieve the same thing, which is something musically beautiful. You know, as the kids take part in that, it's something that our entire community, you know, can really benefit from because the music is beautiful. And to see kids working together and playing music together, it's just phenomenal. So whatever we as adults can do to help propel that and protect that, I mean, I think that's our civic obligation.
Recently, we talked to Quinn Kelsey, opera star, and then also the opera tenor, Taupupua, from Tonga. And he had shared how he had been there in Tonga, and he played with the student orchestra there. And he said, you know, people don't realize that you can't just run down to the store and buy a new set of strings when there is no store. He came away thinking, you know, I really need to do something to help either, you know, with the instruments or just because, you know, he knows the importance of what music can do.
Yes, that's right. Music can heal. Music can inspire us. Music can give us a chance to reflect and give us a space, you know, an important safe space to think and interpret. And as we lean into that, especially, you know, in times where there's a lot of uncertainty, music is something that is lifelong. And we can connect with each other through music. We can have conversations about music that we like or we don't like. We can go out and enjoy, you know, a concert, go to a symphony concert, go to a coffee shop and enjoy some live jazz, or go down and find some free jazz, or, you know, whatever it is in Hawaiian music, and connect with each other, bond with each other through music, through our love of music. And even if we don't understand exactly what we're hearing, it's kind of like, you know, if you feel, if the meter, you know, in your heart just feels like, oh, like you're really full, your heart is really full, and then you love the music and you just want more of it, you crave it. And then you look for ways to experience more music and to create it yourself, or to find creators, find composers and songwriters, and, you know, the whole gamut of, I mean, music is a huge spectrum, right? So I think it's a wonderful thing for us to celebrate, and especially with our kids' music.
Well, you know, when we were talking to Quinn Kelsey, you know, Native Hawaiian opera singer, he had talked about how he feels a responsibility to pass down what he knows and what he loves to the younger generation. I know he said his sister Blythe was doing the education component there with the symphony, but he was feeling like he needed to do more, that he has that responsibility to teach the kids about the classics.
That's right. I mean, I think especially like with young people who are, they're growing up with negative news, they're growing up with all these inundations from all around the world, right? But as kids are involved in learning about classical music and everything that's come before them, I mean, it's just a great way for them to find a safe space.
Well, what's on tap for the symphony for the next 60 years?
That's a great question. I mean, we've got a vision right now. Our vision is of a Hawaii where music is a right. And our mission, which is to foster fun and creative experiences for kids, the idea is, you know, we really want to inspire a deep appreciation for music and lifelong relationships within the culture and across the cultures of our islands. So as we try to get kids from every island to participate, whether it's in music programs in their schools, if they have music in their schools, or if they can participate in community programs or take part in HYS's many offerings, the more that we do that and the more that we can encourage young people to make music, for them to, you know, for us to help them make music a right in their own communities and in their own lives, the better off our community is going to be. And so I think over the next 60 years, I think it's in some ways similar. It's building off of the inspiration that we already have, which is, you know, let's make music a right for Hawaii. Just like how, you know, you've got public schools and public parks and voting and public education and everything. Let's find a way where music can have a seat at the table for every young person. And whether that's through ensemble programs or drop-in classes or anything else, we're going to keep fighting so that every kid can have an opportunity to make music.
That was Hawaii Youth Symphony's Executive Director Randy Wong talking about the group's upcoming concert playing alongside members of the Honolulu Symphony this Wednesday evening at 7:30 in a return to the Neil Blaisdell Center's Concert Hall. Look for links on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to survey the media landscape, and we'll hear from a new kid in town, Aloha State Daily, why its publisher is a familiar voice. Do you have a story idea to share with us? Call or talk back line, record something, 808-792-8217, or you can find the conversation on our website on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.